Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Socks, the Catholic book blogger, and this is episode 4. My guest today is the author of numerous acclaimed biographies of major Catholic literary figures. He's the director of the Center for Faith and Culture and writer in residence at Aquinas College in Nashville, instructor at Homeschool Connections, executive director of Catholic Courses, series editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions, and co-editor of the St. Austin Review. Welcome, Joseph Pierce.
It's good to be on your blog.
Thank you very much, Joseph, for being here and taking your time out today to answer a few questions and chat a little. One of the things I'd like to touch upon today is your conversion story. You wrote about it in your book, Race with the Devil, which I reviewed last year. It's an amazing story and an inspiring story. Can you tell us a little bit about your conversion? Because frankly, I think it's just, it's an amazing story.
Well, yeah, obviously a little bit difficult to distill a full conversion story, which I told in a full-length book, down into a few minutes, but I'll give you the two-minute version, so to speak, nonetheless. Basically, as a 15-year-old, I became heavily involved with radical politics in England. I joined a white supremacist organization called the National Front. I suppose you could have called me a neo-Nazi. I also became very heavily involved with the anti-Catholic terrorist organizations in Northern Ireland, the UDA, the Ulster Defense Association, and the UVF, the Ulster Volunteer Force, and was a member of a Protestant anti-Catholic secret society called the Orange Order. So I was a very, very long way from the Catholic Church, very antagonistic towards Catholicism. But through the reading of G.K. Chesterton and later through the reading of writers such as C.S. Lewis and Hilaire Belloc and John Henry Newman and eventually Thomas Aquinas, I came to a realization that the Catholic Church was indeed the true church and was received into the church in 1989 when I was 28 years old. And that's the two-minute version.
Okay. Now, one thing you mentioned in the book is, and you briefly mentioned it there, was reading the books of some very great, we'll call them literary giants, and which will segue into something we talk about later, is what sparked your conversion. I mean, you actually talk about in the book about your time in prison where you didn't have anything better to do than to read books. So what were you reading that really caused such a turnaround in your life?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about the people that I write about now, one of the reasons that's really become my life's work, my apostolate, so to speak, is I know the power of these great Catholic literary giants to actually win hearts and souls for Christ, because I am one such heart and soul. So, you know, to answer your question, I discovered the works of G.K. Chesterton, first of all, and began to read his works avidly, and subsequently, through Chesterton, came to know the works of Hilaire Belloc. And then I discovered, first of all, C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy, Lewis's own conversion story, and then fell in love with Lewis and started reading everything I could by C.S. Lewis. I didn't mention in my two-minute version of my conversion story that I went to prison twice for my political activities. And during that second prison sentence, I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time, and that was another life-changing experience that obviously led to a lot of things I've written about since. And again, I discovered, I think, during that second prison sentence was the first time I read John Henry Newman. I think the Apologia Pro Vita Sua by Newman's own conversion story I read during that second prison sentence. And I read F.C. Copleston, the great Jesuit convert and philosopher. I read his book on Thomas Aquinas during that second prison sentence. And also Archbishop Sheehan's Apologetics and Catholic Doctrine, which I can't recommend highly enough. And also another book that was very instrumental in my conversion was Carl Adams' Spirit of Catholicism, which I read, I think, just after I got out of prison. So, you know, and I've missed books out. There's lots of sins of omission in that list of books that were influential on me. The works of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago in particular, was also very influential on my road to conversion. So lots of books. If you like, the path, my own path to Rome was paved with great books.
Indeed. And again, many of us are glad that you published your story, your conversion story, because in my opinion, and I may have mentioned this in my review a year ago, is your story illustrates the fact that it's never too late for a person to turn to God. Now, your conversion occurred at 28, but the history you had prior to that, anybody at any time can get that conversion and can do great things afterwards.
I think and hope that my conversion story will show that nobody is so far from God and so far from his church that he can't be open to the Spirit and to conversion. Because, you know, as I've just said, and as you mentioned in your own review of my book, that the few people further from Christ and his church than I was during my dark days of anti-Catholicism and racism and neo-Nazi activity. So if I can come to Christ from the darkness where I found myself as a young man, anybody can come to Christ.
Indeed, indeed. Another thing you mentioned there was your first experience reading Lord of the Rings. And I had a couple people on Facebook mention me asking you this. With the movies, how do you think that has helped the book? And obviously there's some debate on how close to the book they really were. But how do you think the books have influenced the legacy of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings? The movies have influenced.
Yeah, I think there's several ways I'd like to answer that. First of all, my first book on Tolkien, Tolkien Man and Myth, and the book I edited on Tolkien, Tolkien A Celebration, were both published before any of the Jackson movies came out. And they were published in response to the fact that Lord of the Rings won a whole series of opinion polls in the UK as the greatest work of the 20th century, and in some cases the greatest work of literature of all time. In other words, that Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was huge before Peter Jackson came along. Right. It's important to realize that in many ways it would be much truer to say that Peter Jackson has ridden the wave of Tolkien's popularity rather than the other way around. So that's the first thing I'd want to say. But of course, you know, following the success of the Lord of the Rings movies, probably there was certainly an upsurge in the number of people reading the Lord of the Rings, and a whole new generation of readers discovered the Lord of the Rings. So of course, in that sense, Tolkien's work was a beneficiary of Jackson's movies. As regards Jackson's movies themselves, I'd like to distinguish very, very starkly and clearly between the Lord of the Rings movies, in which Jackson did at least pay real lip service, at least, if not real passionate desire, to keep the Tolkien world and Tolkien lovers happy by at least capturing a large part of the spirit of the book, if not the fullness of its Catholicism, then at least a great deal of the spirit of the Lord of the Rings. So for the most part, with many reservations, but for the most part, I can enjoy the Lord of the Rings movies by Jackson, but I can't enjoy the Hobbit movies by Jackson, because the Hobbit movies by Jackson are quite frankly a dereliction and a desecration of a great work of literature in the interest of making a fast buck. And that shows, the movies bear very little similarity to the book. They're just merely a rather sordid exercise in making money. And the irony is, of course, Peter Jackson is cast in the role of Smaug, the dragon, mm-hmm. who has the dragon sickness and basically is hoarding the gold and destroying the spirit in the process.
Yes. So life reflects art there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else is interesting about the time we live in is, you know, at the same time that Tolkien was working on Lord of the Rings, you had another gentleman, C.S. Lewis, creating his Narnia series.
Yeah, there was a wonderful cross-fertilization of inspiration and ideas between Tolkien and Lewis. I think there's no real secret that obviously Tolkien was a major influence on Lewis's conversion to Christianity, and also Tolkien's work in Middle Earth, his early works, the stories that would later be published in part as the Silmarillion, and indeed his writing of The Hobbit and his writing of The Lord of the Rings were hugely influential upon C.S. Lewis's writing of Narnia. So, Lewis owes a great debt to Tolkien inspirationally, although Tolkien said that he considered Lewis a great encourager, and if it wasn't for C.S. Lewis, he probably would not have finished The Lord of the Rings. So in that sense, we also have to thank C.S. Lewis for giving us that great work by Tolkien, which may never have been finished and therefore never published if it hadn't been for the encouragement that Lewis gave Tolkien.
Right. And again, history repeats itself. You have the Lord of the Rings movies. You have Narnia movies. You have any opinion on the Narnia movies themselves, what's been out thus far?
Yeah, basically, the line of Witching Ward Road was disappointing but okay, and everyone since then has been worse. basically, I'm not that impressed with the Narnia adaptations at all. Quite frankly, I prefer the very low-tech, low-budget BBC version, yes, of the 1980s, mm-hmm, to the multi-megabuck sort of Disney-fied version, which we've got more recently. No, not happy with the modern adaptations of Narnia, I must confess. Give me the books anytime.
There you go. Now, obviously, these two players had some very large works in Lord of the Rings and Narnia. But what are some other works by both of these authors that people may not be familiar with that are lesser known?
Well, I think that as regards Tolkien, those that are seriously interested in what makes Tolkien tick and why is The Lord of the Rings a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, which was how Tolkien described it, and what was the philosophy of myth that underpinned his work, which is profoundly Catholic also. In order to understand that, they need to read The Silmarillion and also Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, his short story Leif by Niggle, and also his wonderful poem, Mythopoeia. They I'd say, were indispensable for somebody who really wants to delve deeper into Tolkien. And Tolkien's published letters are also a gold mine of wonderful insights into Tolkien's faith and life and his creativity. As regards C.S. Lewis, well, one doesn't really know where to start or end, because basically everything that Lewis wrote is worth reading. Obviously, in terms of nonfiction, the work that probably we'd have to recommend is Mere Christianity, but we could mention many others. Probably his finest work of literature, but also the most difficult, perhaps, is Till We Have Faces. His space trilogy is wonderful. Pilgrim's Regress, his conversion story, Surprised by Joy, the other conversion story he wrote. I mean, I really don't know where to stop, quite frankly, mm-hmm, with C.S. Lewis. But at the moment, I would say my favorite, I've reverted to my childhood in many ways. I've become childlike, hopefully, and not childish. and I really have learned through reading them with my 6-year-old daughter to really have rediscovered the beauty and magic of Narnia. And I would say that Narnia, for me, is la creme de la creme. Really, the best of Lewis is to be found in those children's stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lino on Facebook wanted me to ask you this question, and you briefly mentioned this in that list, is the Space Trilogy. He's reading that trilogy, he's on a third book, and his question is, he'd like to hear your thoughts on this seemingly unknown series, especially Perelandra, the second book.
Well, I personally think that if someone were to do it properly, those three books would make three wonderful movies, actually, with the abilities we have for special effects now, they could be brought to life. Of course, we know how often Hollywood ruins things and turns them into travesties, but I'm just saying there's a potential that'll make great movies out of those three books. Yeah, and I you say that they're forgotten or unknown. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I do think I would agree they're not as widely read as they deserve to be. All three of them are wonderful. Perelandra, I normally find that Perelandra, with the middle of the books, the one that I was asked to comment on, is the one that's most popular with, should we say, people who are theologians who perhaps normally prefer to read non-fiction to fiction, because a large part of Perelandra is really an intellectual engagement between the sort of the unman, the Satan figure, and Ransom, who's obviously called to save Perelandra from suffering the same fate as our world by being tempted by Satan into falling. So there's a great deal of dialogue of the deepest theology. So if that's your thing, then that's probably going to be your favorite of the three books. Personally, and I loved Perelandra, I should say, and I also love theology, mm-hmm, in case anybody should suggest otherwise. But for me, I think my favorite of the three books is the third one, That Hideous Strength. There's lots of very interesting things going on there that I think are very prescient and prophetic of what's happened in the half century or more since they were written.
Yep. And then, of course, there's Lewis's Screwtape Letters.
Yeah, I didn't mention them, and I apologize for not doing so, although I must confess, if this is a time for confession, that I find the Screwtape phenomenon the least appealing to me personally. I find that getting that close to the devil is a bit uncomfortable. It's obviously meant to be uncomfortable, but I actually also feel a little bit dirty and slimy having having done it, and I don't really feel the need myself
right.
To spend too much time in Screwtape's company. But I know that it's been very influential and very helpful for many people in understanding the nature of evil and helping them overcome their own sins. So by grace, of course, mm-hmm. with grace. But nonetheless, speaking personally, then they're not the books of Lewis I'm likely to return to most often.
Okay. Now I have another book here that I'm actually looking at right now. I've been browsing through this. It was recently released by Ignatius Press last fall, and it's called The Catholic Literary Giants, A Field Guide to the Catholic Literary Landscape. And in this book, which comes in at 400-some pages, it's basically, and I've been browsing it, it's a smorgasbord of Catholic authors. You cover Chesterton, Belloc, Shakespeare, Dante, Oscar Wilde, Evelyn Waugh, and the list goes on and on. How did you develop this massive volume?
Well, basically, again, confession time here. I edit a magazine, as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, that called the St. Austin Review, which is a Catholic cultural journal. I've been editing that for over 13 years. And I write for lots of other journals over the years, and I could list them, but I think they're listed up to a point in the acknowledgments at the beginning of that book. So many of the chapters in that book are actually essays I wrote for various other publications at various times, but they've been arranged thematically so that the book actually holds together, I think, very, very well. So there's a section on the basically Catholic literary landscape over the last 150 years, the Catholic revival, and then there's a section on Chesterton and Belloc, and then there's a section on T.S. Eliot, Wasteland Generation, and then there's a section on Tolkien and Lewis and the Inklings, and then the final section is actually more things considered. So that's the anything that's not covered in those sections is covered in that final section. So that's where you'll find the essays on Shakespeare and Dante, etc. So I'm very pleased with it. I think it actually the art of the essay is something which was obviously huge in Chesterton's day, not so much these days, but I do think in many ways some of the best writing I've done has been in the form of the essay. Mm-hmm. So Catholic Literary Giants actually allows that aspect of my writing to get an audience, a readership beyond the actual, you know, when it's actually read in the magazines themselves. So right. I'm delighted that Ignatius has published it, and I hope it does well.
Yes, it's definitely, as you mentioned, it's taken from different sources, different articles. Obviously, it wasn't sat down and written at the same time, but married together, it all fits.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the point is what I did in actually constructing the book, if you like, was to arrange my writings into various themes that they held together cohesively and coherently and formed a whole, which, you know, you could almost believe at least had been written as a book. But yes, I say confession and full disclosure makes me confess that is not the case.
One thing that you mentioned in here, one writer that people may not even think about, may come as a surprise, is Saint Pope John Paul II.
Yeah, indeed. We had a special theme issue of the St. Austin Review some years back when St. John Paul II was still the Pope, and I wrote an essay at Totus Tuus, Tribute to Truly Holy Father, I think it was called, as the editorial for that issue, and that's what's included in the book. And I'm very, very pleased, of course, to actually have had the opportunity to pay my own personal tribute to such a great Pope, who now, of course, is also such a great saint. So he wasn't a saint when I wrote the essay, but he's been canonized since. So if you like, my praise for him in there has been vindicated by Holy Mother Church.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed it has. Now, talked about Tolkien, we talked about Lewis. One we've briefly touched upon but haven't spent a lot of time on is G.K. Chesterton. Obviously, he has a massive amount of books out there. That doesn't even include some of the more fictionalized things, such as the Father Brown series. If someone wanted to get into G.K. Chesterton, where should they start and where should they go?
Well, I often say, actually, when asked that question, I'm asked it quite often, that I would actually start, if you've never read any Chesterton at all, I would start either with my own biography of Chesterton, mm-hmm. which was the first book I published as a Catholic, called Wisdom and Innocence, A Life of G.K. Chesterton. And that's because it goes through the story of Chesterton's life, but it also, as it does so, covers the books that he wrote as he wrote them chronologically in the context of his life, and quoting selectively from them and discussing what they're about. So it's a good introductory course in the works of Chesterton. And another option, just to show that I'm not just trying to sell my own products here, would be the works of Dale Olquist as well. Dale Olquist has written a number of books on Chesterton, Common Sense 101, The Apostle of Common Sense, etc., which are also excellent introductions to the work of Chesterton. Chesterton's writing style is sort of, I almost had to say, idiosyncratic. He's got a very singular writing style that some people fall in love with and other people have great difficulty dealing with. Mm-hmm. So I do think that for most people, rather than diving in the deep end and reading Chesterton directly and perhaps drowning in the process, it's safer perhaps to be introduced to him via my work or via the work of Dale Olquist.
Oh, very good. One thing that I want to touch upon here, because I'm seeing on my end of things as a blogger who reviews books and talks to authors, but on your side of the coin as an author, it seems that in the last couple of years that the Catholic book market has seen a resurgence. Are you seeing that on your end?
Yes, I am. I mean, thanks be to God, and thanks to that new revival. I do think we're seeing a new Catholic cultural revival, a new Catholic literary revival. I mean, my book, Literary Converts, basically charted the Catholic revival in the 20th century, and that revival really could be said to start with the Romantic revival and then with Newman's conversion and goes right through to, you know, the death of Tolkien and Lewis in the 60s and 70s. But there did seem to be, you know, In the last couple of decades of the last century, something of a lull or a doldrums, if you like, in Catholic culture. But what I think we're seeing in the first decade, now moving into the second decade of this new century, is also a renewal of that Catholic revival. And I think that's being shown the number of good books being written, mm-hmm, by many good authors, and the number of good books being read by a reinvigorated, revitalized Catholic market out there. So I'm very, very positively persuaded about the future of the Catholic revival in the 21st century. For instance, at the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College, that of which I'm the director, we've just launched the Aquinas Award for Fiction. The first award will be given this summer. Okay. And I'm doing that because I'm just very, very pleasantly moved by the number of new works of fiction by Catholic authors that are being published by several publishers. And the Catholic Writers Guild, of course, is doing very well at the moment. So all of those things together, I thought this is the time is ripe to launch the Aquinas Award for Fiction. I hope that's going to be a great success. I hope that's going to also serve as a catalyst in this new Catholic revival. I think these are exciting days. I mean, they're dangerous days. They're challenging days. We see the rise of secular fundamentalism, etc. But they're also very exciting days because side by side with that negative side, there is this new Catholic revival we see happening.
Yes, and you know, you see that, as you mentioned, the negativity coming up, but by the grace of God, there is always the positive side that comes up to combat that.
Yeah, indeed. So we see it throughout history. I mean, the whole history of the church, you know, there are periods where the church, it seems to be doing well in a worldly sense, but whenever the church is doing well in a worldly sense, it seems to go hand in hand with corruption within the church. And then there's times of persecution when the worldly will think that the church is finished and done for, and that's happened throughout history, whether it be the time of the catacombs or right through the various times of the Reformation, the Arian heresy, etc. You could go on and on and on. And whenever, you know, the death of the church has been predicted by the world, it's always followed by a resurrection. That's the way it is. And so we see, if you like, towards the end of the 20th century, this doldrums, this era of indifference and even theological modernism and heresy and a lack of cultural renewal, a cultural revival. But then here we go, just when the Catholic Church was predicted to be dying, we have this presence of this revival in the midst of the darkness of the world in which we live.
Yeah. Now, switch gears here a little bit. You're not just an author, but you're also a teacher. You do work with Homeschool Connections and obviously Catholic courses, which you're heavily involved with. And one of the things that I want to personally thank you for is teaching my daughter about the Lord of the Rings, which she learned through your Catholic courses DVDs. How did you get involved with these two endeavors, and what future plans do you have with them?
Well, I should mention as well, of course, that I am also a professor of literature at Aquinas College in Nashville, and that's what I receive the salary for, so we should probably mention that also. I've been teaching for Homeschool Connections, I think, now for maybe 3 years. I'm not really sure. They approached me. I think maybe I speak quite often at Catholic homeschooling conferences around the country, and Homeschool Connections often had tables at those conferences, and we got to know each other. Maureen Whitman and Walter, who basically run Homeschool Connections, we started talking, and they asked if I'd prepare to teach for them. I was a little bit skeptical at first about wanting to teach online, but I dipped my toe in the water and haven't looked back. I mean, I think Homeschool Connections is a wonderful institution, wonderful organization, which is really bringing really, really good Catholic teachers and professors into the homes of homeschooling Catholic kids. So that's wonderful. And as regards Catholic courses, again, the folks at St. Benedict Press and Tan Books, who have been very, very supportive of my work, publishing some of my books, they also asked me, as they were planning to launch Catholic courses, if I'd be prepared to be the executive director. And I was obviously honored to be asked. And so I accepted. And as well as being the executive director, I've also taught three courses with them, a course on the Lord of the Rings, a course on the Hobbit, a course on Shakespeare.
Yes.
And also, actually, I have filmed a course on Chesterton, but that is yet to be released. But that's one to look forward to.
Oh, good. So you definitely keep busy. Do you have any projects you're currently working on book-wise that you could share with us?
Well, I'm always working on several writing projects at once, some of which I'd rather keep under wraps for various reasons that may or may not may become evident later. But certainly I'm hoping to finish a book on The Challenge of Chesterton that's sort of in the works. That one's not a secret at all. And I'm also hoping to finish a book on The Great Books at some point. But that's also, again, in the works, and perhaps another book on Shakespeare. But on top of that, with another couple of projects that I'd like to keep a little bit quiet at the moment.
And that's quite all right. So do you have anything you want to add?
And of course, on top of that, I should say as well, Pete, yes. They're my book projects, but I'm writing regularly, of course. I write the editorial for every issue of the St. Austin Review. I've been writing for the Imaginative Conservative website every week for over a year now. So I write regularly for them. I write for Chronicles magazine, Latin Mass magazine. So, I'm also apart from writing the books, I'm actually doing a lot more journalism these days, right, if that's the right word for it, writing essays. And as I say, I actually really enjoy writing essays. There's a sort of a different art to writing an essay to writing a book, and I enjoy both, and I'm happy and privileged to be able to do both.
Yes, and we've mentioned this a couple of times, so let's go ahead and talk about it a little bit. Is St. Austin Review, I visit the website, I read your stuff there. How did that come about, your involvement with it, and who created it, and just talk a little bit about what it is in case people are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, the St. Austin Review is a great labor of love of mine. It was launched actually in the UK back in September 2001, and I was asked to be the editor from day one, from the first issue, and I've been an editor ever since. Ironically and providentially, I think, the actual date of the launch of St. Austin Review was the day after I moved to the States. So although I was the editor, I was not actually there at the official party in London that launched it. But I actually took that to be providential, because I don't think the St. Austin Review would have survived if it had been dependent upon the UK market. So my moving over here allowed me to promote it in the United States, and so it's gone from strength to strength over here, and we have far more readers over here now than we have in the UK. And it comes out six times a year. It's a Catholic cultural magazine. We've had all sorts, some of the finest writers in the Catholic Church have written for it over the years, including Pope Benedict, actually, when he was the humble Cardinal Ratzinger gave us the first English language rights on his essay on Catholicity. So we've had another cardinals of the church. Cardinal Biffy's written for us. Cardinal Burke is a great admirer and subscriber of the St. Austin Review. And Peter Craft and Thomas Howard and these great Scott Harm, these great Catholic writers have written for us at some stage or other. So I would encourage, those that enjoy your blog are probably going to enjoy the St. Austin Review.
Yes.
They can check out the website, which is at staustinreview.com. They should also, having done that, click on the archives to look at the print edition of the magazine, and hopefully subscribe to the print edition of the magazine, because it's a beautiful magazine produced the old-fashioned way on paper, and I'd like to continue to doing that, and so we obviously need subscribers.
Yes, and I'll put a link to the website in the show notes to this episode for you.
Thanks so much, Pete. I really appreciate that.
I guess that's it for today. Thank you so much for being a guest, Joseph. It was great talking to you. Good suggestions on books, and just thank you very much for being on the show today.
Well, my pleasure, and you keep up the great work you're doing. May you go from strength to strength.
Thank you very much. So, folks, until next time, open a book, keep reading, build your faith, and go evangelize. God bless.
I never knew I miss myself. My soul abides in you. I miss myself. You were there before. I miss myself. Walk on distant shore. I miss myself. Look what I've become. I miss myself. When I was young.